The months-long investigation into Cincinnati's police chief has been extended yet again. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, what the city says about needing more time, plus a legislative effort to ban ranked choice voting in Ohio, and what's behind Republicans' opposition, and what President Trump said about data centers in his State of the Union. Joining me now to get the news review started is Cleveland.com State House reporter Anna Staver. Welcome back, Anna.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. And state lawmakers, as I mentioned, are moving to block ranked choice voting. First, explain how ranked choice voting works.
Okay, so I like to think of it as if we were all trying to decide what kind of cuisine we wanted for dinner. So you would rank your preferences. So I might say Indian, then Italian, then Chinese. And if it turns out that no one in our group wanted Indian but me, that vote would then drop off and my vote would go towards Italian. And we would keep going until a majority had decided on dinner. So it's basically like that. You rank the candidates in order of your preference. And if nobody likes your number one pick, then your vote goes to your second pick or your third pick until we have a winner.
Okay. Well, what would this bill do if it were to become law?
So it says that no, like, city, county, municipality could use this kind of ranking system. And if they did, there'd be some real penalties. They would stop giving the local government fund, which is a bucket of state dollars that go out to cities to help them cover their costs. So there's a real stick tied to deciding to go with a ranked choice voting system.
Do any local governments use this form of voting now in Ohio?
No. Actually, Cincinnati, I guess, did way back in the day. And then it went to, like, regular, you choose one candidate. But this city of Lakewood up near Cleveland actually was thinking about putting it on the ballot this November as a charter amendment. So this would effectively block that.
Why are state lawmakers so opposed to this?
Oh, this is so interesting. They say that it's, you know, one person, one vote. That is fundamental to who we are as a society, right? Like, you pick one candidate and you go with them. They think it can be confusing. And yeah, I think you need some messaging around this, right? Like, especially if there's like 20 people on the ballot, you actually don't have to order everybody if you don't want to. So you don't have to rank everyone, but it would be a different way of doing it. And they think it would just be too confusing, too complicated. And we're just supposed to pick one person.
Is the opposition to this form of voting, is it bipartisan?
It is. So what's really interesting is the support to ban it is bipartisan and the support to keep it. And it's really interesting. So one of the arguments that I hear is, look, there are a lot of districts all across the state where the primary decides the election, right? Either it's a safe Democrat district or a safe Republican district. And having this ranked choice would actually create competition. Because you could sort of say, look, this is the, I would prefer, let's say you're a Republican living in Cincinnati, right? The Democratic candidate's probably going to win. So you could put the Republican as number one, but then you could maybe rank the Democratic candidates in terms of who you could live with.
Is that part of the reason for the support and opposition to this bill because of all those safe districts?
Because it would upend a lot of safe districts potentially.
Yeah. Are any state lawmakers concerned about the threat to withhold state funding that's part of this bill, that big stick you talked about?
I mean, some local groups have said they think it violates local control, right? So they are, if you're just trying to affect how you elect people in your own community, there's some rumblings that maybe that takes away from home rule.
There are, as you mentioned, fans of ranked choice voting. What are they saying about this proposed ban?
So we have a group called Rank the Vote Ohio, and they're trying to bring ranked choice voting to Ohio. It has actually some Republican and Democratic, like, former lawmakers who are helping get it off the ground. So they're saying, look, they have long thought they would go to the ballot. They're not going to go this November. So don't think like we're going to vote on this anytime soon. But they're calling this legislation like a speed bump on the road to ranked choice voting. We'll see how that works out. But they're optimistic that within a couple of years, they'll be able to actually put something before voters.
Interesting. So what's next with this bill?
So it passed the Senate, then it passed the House, but because the House made changes, it's got to go back to the Senate before it goes to the governor.
Okay. Is that going to happen pretty quickly, do you think?
Yeah, we think so. The Senate will have session next week, so it could be to the governor by like the end of next week.
Okay. Well, I want to switch gears. Tell us about this federal antitrust lawsuit against a hospital system that's based in Columbus.
Yeah, this is so interesting. So it's actually the federal government and Attorney General Dave Yost. And they're saying that Ohio Health has manipulated contracts with insurance companies and that's resulted in everyone paying more for their insurance in that area. So there's a couple of different allegations here. The one that I think is interesting is it alleges that their contracts have a gag rule. So it says that Ohio Health contracts prevent insurers from telling you that, let's say, you could save hundreds of dollars by getting your MRI at a different outpatient facility instead of an Ohio Health hospital. And so that would effectively make sure that you have to use Ohio Health or you would default there, and even though it would be more money. And it's really interesting because Ohio Health is not the only kind of hospital system in the country that has these allegedly, and I should say allegedly, like contract clauses. And so if the federal government can win this, then it could have a large change in how we access health insurance across the country.
Is that clause what the lawsuit refers to as an all or nothing clause? Like you got to do all your business with this hospital system? Or is that something else?
That is something else. So there's a bunch of different clauses that the federal government doesn't like about Ohio Health contracts. This one was Ohio Health has a number of hospitals. And in downtown Columbus, we got a lot of options, but it has a lot of hospitals in the rural areas around Central Ohio. And if you're going to be, say, a Central Ohio employer, you've got to provide access to some of those because people commute. And so what the contract says is if you want that rural health, that rural hospital in your network, you have to take all of our hospitals. So it's all or nothing.
How big is Ohio Health?
They are pretty big. They have about 35% of the market share here in Columbus.
Wow. And all these different clauses and things, I just want to make sure I understand what Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is saying that's meant for consumers. Is he saying this ends up costing them more for their health care?
Yes. He's saying that. So he's basically saying that, yes, we're all paying more because Ohio Health is so big that it doesn't have to compete. And it's really an antitrust lawsuit, right? This is the too big to fail. And he's saying it's so big that it can keep itself expensive.
Can you talk more about what the broader implications are if the government wins this lawsuit?
So because it's dealing with antitrust, right, it would essentially be saying that this type of contract is getting in the way of the free market, that you are using this to enrich yourself in a way that the market wouldn't give you otherwise. And so if we find out, right, that's a big if, but if Ohio Health loses this case, then presumably it sets a precedent for any other hospital system in the country that uses similar clauses, like these gag rules, these all or nothing provisions.
How has Ohio Health responded to all this?
Very carefully, right? Because it's a lawsuit. This was only filed the other week. So they have not put out like an actual like response. They haven't filed one with the court yet. Their statement has just been like, we're working with the federal government. We're working with the Attorney General's office. And we're confident that our contracts are on the up and up. But they haven't gone like point for point yet.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's get back to the Ohio legislature. Ohio already has a law that blocks people accused or convicted of violent crimes from profiting off book deals or movie rights. But now two Hamilton County lawmakers want to expand that. How do they want to expand it?
Yeah, they want to block crowdfunding, like GoFundMe. And this actually ties to a Cincinnati case. It's the death of Deputy Larry Henderson, which I know that trial was supposed to start very soon. But essentially, the man who hit Deputy Henderson with his vehicle and killed him last year, his family raised more than $50,000 for his defense on a GoFundMe. And Mr. Henderson's widow found that very upsetting that the man accused of killing her husband could make all this money off a crowdfunding website.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember, I could be remembering this correctly, but I can't remember if the accused man's family put up that GoFundMe or if it was someone else who was raising the money in his defense, but that definitely was a big news story when it happened at the time. Can you talk more about what Lori Henderson, the widow of Hamilton County Sheriff's Deputy Larry Henderson, told lawmakers? I mean, it sounds like she had pretty emotional testimony about all this.
Yeah, she definitely teared up and choked up a number of times during her testimony. It was hard. You know, it's still very raw for her. It hasn't even been a year yet since her husband was killed. And she essentially said it was traumatizing all over again to see this GoFundMe and to see some of the comments. Because, you know, when you donate, for those who have never donated, you can say $20 and then write a little something. And actually, Lori didn't, but there was another deputy there who read out some of the comments. And she was like, it was just really hard to live through in the days after Larry died.
Yeah. What would this bill require from crowdfunding sites like the GoFundMes of the world?
So it would require that they not raise money for anyone accused or convicted of a violent crime, and that if they were found to have been raising money, that they refund it to the people who gave to the GoFundMe. And it would allow the attorney general to go after anybody who violated that.
So those sites would face some real penalties if they don't follow those rules under the new law.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a really difficult, it's because, you know, on the other hand, people say everyone's entitled to a legal defense, right? But what they kept saying over and over was, this is not about your right to an attorney. This is about whether you can profit off a crime. And the concern was that if you can raise money like this, does it incentivize people to commit crimes? That's kind of how we came up with these laws in the first place.
Where does this bill stand?
So it's very early. It's gone through a few hearings, but it seems to have wide bipartisan support. This is not one of those bills where there's going to be a lot of back and forth. I think it can move very quickly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Anna. This was very, very helpful. I have been talking with Cleveland.com State House reporter Anna Staver. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Up next, President Trump talks data centers in his State of the Union, and local lawmakers are listening. This is Cincinnati Edition. As more data center projects are proposed across Ohio, the massive facilities got a mention from the commander-in-chief. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the data center proposal and President Trump's State of the Union address and a massive data center project in Adams County is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you. Dan, we talked to you a few weeks ago about the possibility that a data center could be built in Adams County near an old power plant. Now you've learned there's a data center in the works, and it could consume a whole lot of power.
1,300 megawatt is the size of this thing. That's enough to power 31 times Adams County's total consumption.
That sounds like a lot.
That is a lot. Yeah. And it would be one of the biggest data centers in Ohio if it's ultimately built. There are a handful now that are over 1,000 megawatts or a gigawatt, and there are more coming. But this one would rank, I believe it's third in Ohio. There's two ahead of it in this pipeline that I looked at from PJM, which is the company that manages the energy grid for a 13-state region, which includes Ohio and parts of Kentucky and Indiana.
So what would that kind of energy consumption mean for Adams County, and how are residents there responding to all that?
Residents are worried that it'll mean higher bills, and there's reason for them to worry about it because PJM has been putting out reports indicating that data centers in their territory have cost consumers $16 billion. That's in a 13-state region, a cost spread across 67 million consumers. But it's definitely an issue because the cost of data centers at this point are being handled by everybody who, you know, pays for energy service, because utilities have to build infrastructure in order to get the power from wherever it's generated to the site where the data center operates. And a lot of times that means that there are millions of dollars invested by utilities just to be able to serve this new power-hungry customer.
And so are there a lot of residents who are opposing this and kind of becoming activists to really set some rules and guidelines if this is to happen?
Yes, there are. I think we covered a hearing or a meeting, a public meeting, where citizens got together and talked about these issues. Several dozen showed up for that meeting. I think there was another one last night. I'm not sure how many attended. There are several active members of Facebook forming groups and sharing information. And it's really kind of interesting. They're doing their own record requests and they're trying to find out exactly where the power source is going to be. Is there going to be a nuclear generator somewhere in Adams County? That's the burning question of the week. Yeah, there are a lot of active citizens who are trying to protect what they consider to be an unspoiled part of the country. And they don't want a lot of noise and light and gas fumes around their farms.
So where does this project stand in the whole approval process that it would need before it gets built, if it does get approval?
One thing they need an agreement from PJM, the grid operator, to have access to the power. They need an agreement from the utility to supply that power. That would be AES Ohio, the former Dayton Power and Light. They need environmental approvals because the site where they are likely going to go is a former landfill site. And they're asking the EPA for approval of a wetland mitigation plan because they're going to, it's a very hilly, cavernous site. And what they're trying to do is level it so that they can put 12 industrial buildings in. And that's going to cause impact to wetlands within that 1,000-acre site. And so they're trying to get EPA approval to do that. I think there's also an approval that they need from the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm trying to get a copy of that and learn more about what the timeline is for those approvals. And, you know, they also need zoning. They don't need zoning. That's one advantage of being in Adams County. There is no zoning. You know, one of the townships in Adams County, Monroe, is developing its own land use plan as a potential way of deciding where, if anywhere, these sites can go in the township. Sprigg Township is also looking at alternatives to zoning to try to regulate, you know, what happens in the weeks and months ahead. And then finally, Adams County, the commissioners have to do some intervention here because as these projects get further down the road, data center developers will seek subsidies, tax abatements, and other, you know, agreements from the county in order for them to build and operate these data centers.
Sounds like that could all take a really long time, huh?
I think that is why it takes, you know, months, if not years, to go from, you know, proposal to completed project.
Well, data centers are such a big deal these days that President Trump even talked about them during his State of the Union address this week. What did he say about them?
He said that he talked all the tech companies into building their own power generators when they build data centers. He said that negotiated what he calls the new rate payer protection pledge. And he says they can build their own power plants as part of their factory so that no one's prices will go up. And in many cases, the price of electricity will go down for the community and substantially down. Hmm. That's what he said in his State of the Union address.
What kind of response did you hear from Ohio lawmakers to that?
Well, I talked to a Democrat who actually likes the proposal. This is Tristan Rader. He's a Democrat who represents Lakewood and West Cleveland in House District 13. And, you know, he's been touting the idea of data centers bringing their own generation to their sites and making their own power because, you know, he thinks it will keep consumers who are not data centers from paying the extra freight for the rising cost of energy. What's happening is that there are so many data centers, you know, opening in Ohio now that the demand for power outstrips the supply, and that is driving up prices on the wholesale market. So one of the ways PJM operates is they go out to the market and they buy energy that gets distributed to their territory. And they do these in auctions. And so in the last few auctions, the price of their wholesale price of energy has been, you know, skyrocketing. Supporters of this idea of generating your own power on a data center site say that, you know, the more power you can create for yourself, the less you have to buy on the open market. You know, the thinking is that that'll drive the price of energy, or at least keep it from skyrocketing as more data centers come online.
Are there any questions about whether that approach that the president is suggesting will lower costs for household customers?
There are lots of questions about it. There are people who say that creating all these new power generating sites has led to rising prices for all the materials you need to build a power plant. And, you know, while it may be cheaper long term to generate your own power, to build them and pay for that also takes money, and that'll add to the cost of energy. There's also criticism of the president's plan because it doesn't address the power grid. It doesn't address the new substations, the new, you know, power lines, the high performance power lines that you need to get these massive energy loads from one part of the country to the other. And there are projects, I mean, I was reviewing the list of projects that PJM has pending, and there's at least $2 billion worth of transmission upgrades that I was able to find in the records there. So, and that's just for the state of Ohio. So it's not cheap to build an energy plant, to build a power generating plant, and it's not cheap to bring the energy from the site of that plant to the source where it's needed, which is at the data center. Whether or not you have your own data center, there are still costs associated with distributing it, the power.
What have Ohio regulators been doing to try to kind of rein in these data center costs?
Well, AEP, which is one of the biggest utilities in Ohio by territory, I think they operate in 61 of 88 counties, they brought a proposal to the PUCO, which approved it, and it basically requires utilities or data centers who are thinking about establishing in Ohio to guarantee a certain level of financial commitment and sign a contract with the utility operator. AEP was worried about speculative projects coming in, and people would build a data center and say, we want this much power, so AEP would have to invest a ton of money to bring that energy to the site. And then, you know, if the speculative center never drew customers, then they were out all that money for the distribution costs. What they did was they set up a tariff system where in order to get power from the utility, you have to agree to you know, invest so much in distribution. And the whole idea was to keep the cost of data centers from intruding on regular consumers, you know, people who buy electricity for their homes. That has been seen as successful. AEP just put out a report recently where it said they had 30,000 megawatts of proposals in front of them. And by requiring all of these steps, that kind of shook out the people who weren't serious about it. And they ended up with less than 6,000 watts or megawatts that they had to do deals for. The state lawmaker that I mentioned, Tristan Rader, he is a co-sponsor of a bill that would basically extend that policy statewide, because right now it only affects service territory belonging to AEP, and he wants to adopt a policy like it in the rest of Ohio, so that data centers would have to sign a contract, an electric service agreement, and guarantee that, you know, they were going to be around long enough to pay for some of the infrastructure that they're requiring, you know, in order for the data center to open. Hmm.
Well, I know you and your colleagues at WCPO have been talking with people who live near these proposed data centers. What do they think about what the state is doing and what the president has proposed?
I think they wish it would all go away, the folks I've been talking to. I mean, there are people who think that it would be good for the county to reuse the industrial sites, the power plants that used to have 700 employees. But a lot of the people enjoy Adams County because it's a quiet, you know, agricultural area. And they really don't want this kind of industry in this area. They think it'll spoil the natural woods around them. And they don't think the cost will be borne by data centers alone. They think their rates are going to go up because of it. They question whether there will be many jobs associated with it, because once the data centers are up and running, it doesn't really take a lot of employees. I think it's like 50 employees per 100 megawatts, something like that. So some of these data centers, even one that's 1,300 megawatts, may only have 100 or 200 employees. And so they don't think that's worth it in terms of what you give up instead of what you are, you know, gaining with new jobs and new investment. The other point is a lot of the new investment is not taxed, because data centers have been getting big tax abatements, 30-year tax abatements for up to 100% of the tax that they would have paid.
Well, I have been talking with WCPO9i team reporter Dan Monk. Dan, thanks so much for your time today and this great reporting.
Thank you very much.
Up next, a push to make Hamilton County Democrats more progressive. This is Cincinnati Edition.
The investigation into Cincinnati's police chief has extended, and Cincinnati City Council took action this week to limit the city's cooperation with federal immigration enforcement. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to discuss all of that and more are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach and Becca.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy.
I want to start with you, Becca. Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thiege's been on paid leave for months now. What's happening with this investigation into her leadership?
Yeah, so she was first placed on paid leave in October for an investigation into the effectiveness of her leadership. That original contract with local law firm FTB Gibbons, this was formerly Frost Brown Todd before a merger more recently than that. This was supposed to go through the end of the year and would look into several questions from city administration about whether Thiege had been an effective police chief. This was amid a lot of public pushback and criticism about public safety last year. It was a really difficult summer. Some very high-profile incidents, as well as some increase in violent crime, but mostly in property crime in certain areas of the city over the summer. So that contract was supposed to go through February 28th, which is Saturday, tomorrow. But we did get news from the city manager's office this week that that contract has been extended for a second time. This is the second extension, and it will now go through the end of March.
So is that going to cost the city more to extend this contract again?
It will not. The first contract extension did come with additional money. The contract was originally through December 31st, and that was for up to $40,000, depending on the hourly rate of various attorneys that were assigned to participate in this investigation. The extension that went through February 28th added another $9,000 to the contract, so we're up to $49,000. A spokesperson for the city manager's office says this contract extension through the end of March does not have any additional funding attached to it.
What has Chief Thigee's lawyer said about all this? Have you heard from her lawyer recently?
From the very beginning, Stephen M. of Finney Law Firm has said that the city officials are using Thigee as a political scapegoat. They're facing a lot of criticism, not just locally, but this was a national news story for some time, especially after that fight over the summer outside of a bar on 4th Street. I believe that was in July of last year. And it was an election coming up. She was placed on paid leave in October, leading into a mayoral and city council election. So, you know, Stephen M., Thigee's attorney, has said this. She's a scapegoat. She's being used as an excuse to kind of look like they're addressing an issue. We've heard from the law firm a few times since then, but most recently with the contract extension, they did decline to offer any additional comment or answer any questions from us this week.
Okay. Well, speaking of city council, let's talk about some of what city council did this week. Council passed several motions designed to limit the city's cooperation with federal immigration enforcement efforts. What did council do?
Yeah, so there's three motions in particular that were passed this week at city council. One directs the city administration to prohibit city property, so this is city-owned and city-controlled property, from being used as a staging area for federal civil immigration enforcement operations. That's unless there is a law or court order or judicial warrant that would require the city to allow the properties to be used for that purpose. So we're thinking of things like parks, rec centers, health centers, that kind of thing. Also prohibiting the city as a separate motion, prohibiting the city from sharing real-time data from city-owned surveillance technology. So there's a lot of discussion nationally about Flock cameras. It's been a discussion on Cincinnati Edition as well. These are the license plate readers. The city does not have a contract with Flock, but they do have other branded license plate readers. The city also has a large network of surveillance cameras and is increasingly using drones for police operations. So this motion prohibits the city from sharing that data with any third party specifically for the purpose of civil immigration enforcement, again, unless mandated by law, a court order, or a judicial warrant. The third and final motion passed this week related to this directs the city administration to basically investigate its own operations and programs and some public engagement activities, looking for instances where the city is asking a resident about their citizenship or naturalization or immigration status, and that if the city identifies any situations like that, that they remove all those instances, so they stop collecting that information at any point in city programming.
What prompted these motions? Is this all about specific situations locally, or is this about national immigration enforcement, something else completely?
It's really the national discussion we're having right now and the issues we're seeing. Minneapolis was brought up a lot of the ICE and federal officer engagement in Minneapolis in particular. But there is ICE activity happening in Cincinnati. The city has long maintained that the police department is not cooperating or not actively working with ICE or other federal agents on civil immigration enforcement. So there weren't specific concerns or specific situations, I believe, locally that prompted this. But certainly the conversation happening nationally. And there have been advocates attending city council meetings recently asking for exactly these types of situations. Council passed a resolution last month in mid-January, basically urging federal agents to follow local policy in terms of not covering their faces and revealing their identities, and also asking them to wear body cameras. There's nothing the city can do to enforce that. There's no legal reason for federal agents to follow that. And historically, they have not been doing that in other parts of the country. So since that resolution, there have been some advocates saying, hey, you're not doing enough. You need to do more. And I think this is partly a response to that. I will say City Councilmember Anna Albee, who authored two of the three motions that passed today, or passed this week rather, said that one of the reasons it took a long time is that they went through a lot of legal investigation on this with the law department, going back and forth to make sure that the city has legal standing to take these positions and to prevent, you know, city property and resources from being used in this way. And also to address some concerns that Councilmember Scotty Johnson brought up at the final vote on Wednesday, as far as does this limit other partnerships the city has with federal agencies, like the FBI, ATF, or organizations that are working with the city to prevent crime and are working on, you know, criminal investigations. investigations. And Albie says she's been assured by the law department that this does not jeopardize any of those other federal partnerships.
Okay. What are some of the problems, though, that local immigrants are having in Cincinnati? There was some discussion of that during this debate, wasn't there?
There was. This was an interesting, and I wouldn't classify it as part of the debate necessarily, more as a kind of a yes and. But Councilmember Evan Nolan, who is an attorney, his message to the city was that these motions are not all that's happening, that there's more that the city is working on, both on a citywide perspective, but also some individuals. So again, as he is an attorney, he said he has been working recently to help immigrants prepare estate paperwork. So his example was, he says, you can imagine a situation where an immigrant comes to Cincinnati, maybe under temporary protected status. They take a job, they buy a house, they buy a car, they lease a car, they have these financial assets. But then because of some decision made at the federal level, maybe that temporary protective status is taken away. What happens to those assets, and what happens to family members who may be left behind if that person is detained or deported? So one of the things that Nolan says he's been working on, as well as other attorneys in the area, is working with families that, you know, are in danger of having a situation like that occur, to prepare the legal documents that would protect those assets for the family members who might still be here in Cincinnati after.
Well, what are some of the other things the city's been doing to support immigrants locally?
There's a funding aspect of this. I mentioned the resolution that council passed last month that is more symbolic than anything. There's not much that can be enforced with that. Some funding was already in the city's current fiscal year budget, so this was finalized in June of 2025, and that includes funding for local nonprofits like Cincinnati Compass, Santa Maria Community Services, the Hispanic Chamber, and the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center. Recently, council did vote to give an additional $210,000 to the Immigrant and Refugee Law Center, specifically because of some of the concerns we're seeing about immigration enforcement. This funding is using money left over from the fiscal year 2025. So this is part of the carryover budget process. My caveat to that is they passed the funding in motion form, and that directs the administration to prepare an ordinance. They will eventually have to vote on that funding again, but there's every reason to expect that it will pass.
Okay. Well, Zach, I want to turn to you now. You also reported this week on some activities related to federal policies. The U.S. Department of Education says the University of Cincinnati and Ohio State University have both signed an agreement to cut ties with an organization that promotes diversity. Tell us about what happened there.
Yeah, so this stems from an earlier investigation that started last year, really shortly after President Donald Trump took office. And basically what happened was the U.S. Department of Education vowed to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion within the federal government, but also at publicly funded institutions, and that includes colleges. So they began investigating 45 universities for their partnerships with a nonprofit called the PhD Project. And what they do is they connect students with business doctoral degree programs. And with the effort of trying to diversify and broaden the talent pool of business school faculty and business leaders. So that's where this all came from. And, a year had passed by, and then we hadn't really heard anything from the institutions or from the U.S. Department of Education on this. But recently they came out and said 31 of those 45 universities signed a resolution agreement basically to end these investigations.
What problem does the Trump administration have with the PhD project?
Well, the example they pointed to, and they specifically called out an annual two-day conference for prospective doctoral students. And what they allege here is that universities like Ohio State and the University of Cincinnati were a part of this conference, you know, had tables there, and were telling students to go to this thing. And the issue with it was the conference itself, according to the U.S. Department of Education, they claimed it was exclusive to Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous students, which they called discriminatory.
How has the PhD project responded?
They were quick to defend what they do. They said they're, you know, committed to making things more diverse and having these unique events. They said their goal is to put, you know, role models in front of business classrooms And they say that's still their goal. So, you know, even with this, even with some of these broken partnerships with some big universities, you know, and it's not just Ohio State and UC, it's also the University of Michigan, Cal Berkeley, UK, the University of Kentucky, was also part of this as well. So they're standing by it. They, you know, they're not saying it's discriminatory. As far as the PhD project, they're standing by what their goal is.
Do these agreements, as far as you know, require anything else from UC or Ohio State or the other universities that have signed on to them? Is ending their relationship with the PhD project the end of it?
No, not at all. So the PhD project was kind of the main example here. But Ohio State University actually shared that resolution agreement with me. And what was in there was actually an agreement with the federal government that not only would they cut ties with the PhD project, they would also then examine other memberships and other external partnerships they have with organizations and identify any of those that might involve race in their participation or admission, and to report those to the federal government and eventually show proof that they have canceled and ended those partnerships. It also authorizes the Office of Civil Rights within the U.S. Department of Education to actually visit these campuses and interview students and staff and request additional information and data to determine whether these universities are actually following this agreement. So it does actually go a step further than just ending a single partnership. It actually is kind of a prolonged thing where now the universities are reporting this information to the federal government.
Now, you kind of referenced this earlier, but the U.S. Department of Education had an anti-DEI directive for K through 12 schools and higher education institutions. Where does that directive stand?
Well, you know, earlier this month, that directive was struck down in federal court. So that was, aimed at K through 12 schools, aimed at higher education institutions. And basically what the judge says is, you know, these universities don't actually have to follow these directives. They were deemed unlawful. So this is not necessarily schools and universities following a federal law. This is more agreeing to certain demands by the U.S. Department of Education. And, you know, when I speak to faculty at these institutions about these things, they do kind of express that kind of frustration with universities kind of complying in advance and agreeing to these restrictive terms before things actually become law, before they're actually required to do these things. So this actually was released by the U.S. Department of Education, this information about these 33 universities, shortly after that ruling. So these were actually agreed upon before the ruling was officially made and before they withdrew that DEI directive. But essentially, these kind of do the same thing.
Well, Becca, let's come back to you. Tell us about the Cincy Precinct Project. What is it and what are its goals?
Well, the context here and where this starts is the fact that Hamilton County has become really solidly blue. It's been more of a Democratic county, and that Democratic sample ballot carries a lot of weight, not just in the city of Cincinnati, but in countywide races and increasingly in some of the suburbs in Hamilton County. So now there's some local Democrats that are saying, hey, we're not just fighting for elections anymore. You know, we really need to do more to stand up to a second Trump administration and a Republican supermajority at the Ohio State House. So this group is a grassroots effort to pressure the local Democratic Party to move further left, to endorse more progressive candidates, and to be more vocal about opposition to some of the Republican policies they're seeing at the state and federal level.
And this has its roots with precinct executives. What do precinct executives do? Why are they important?
Yeah, this is a little bit in the weeds, and I apologize for that. But a precinct is a geographic area that has no more than 1,400 voters. So there's 563 precincts in Hamilton County. And according to state law, each political party can elect one executive in each precinct. And they typically help get out voter turnout and help campaign for the endorsed candidates for their party. They make up what's called the party's central committee. They elect the party leadership. So in that way, they can influence the priorities of the party. And depending on the jurisdiction, they also either directly endorse candidates. So for Cincinnati City Council and the mayor, for example, or they help decide a smaller committee that endorses candidates for some other races.
That sounds like really important work. So this Cincy Precinct Project, what are the major issues that this group is pushing?
Well, they call themselves Do Something Democrats. And a big message is that they're seeing Democrats, especially at a federal level, really not standing up to the Trump administration in a way that they feel like is enough. Some of the issues listed on the Precinct Project's website include LGBTQIA rights, women's health, immigrants' rights, things like being more democratically responsive and transparent about how things are done at the local level, like who gets endorsements, how that endorsement process happens. Also issues like prioritizing public safety in public schools, public housing, healthcare. It's really a long list of issues that you kind of would expect. But some of the issues are, you know, again, standing up to the Trump administration, but locally trying to be more transparent and open about how things work within the party itself.
How does the county's Democratic leadership respond to this effort?
There's kind of a mixed bag here. So I did speak with the Hamilton County Democratic Party Chair, Alex Linzer. This is an unpaid position. He's been in that job for about a year. He says some of the criticism is really just speculation and misunderstanding about how the process works. So, for example, there's some criticism that the county party endorses based on how much money a candidate has either given to the party in the past or how much they're able to fundraise for a particular race. Linzer says that's simply not true, that there are some pretty recent examples of, you know, where an endorsement has come down to two candidates. One has raised a lot of money, one is a lot more inexperienced, and the more inexperienced candidate got the endorsement. On a bigger picture level, I guess, Linzer does say he agrees the party can do more. He says this is a national conversation that's happening within the Democratic Party. It's not unique to Hamilton County or to Cincinnati. He says that his top priority and the party's top priority right now is the midterm elections in November. But after that, he says this is a very important conversation to have in terms of what are the priorities, what should the Democratic Party focus on? Again, not just to win elections, but what is their platform? What do they stand for? And he says he's open to that conversation. And he welcomes more precinct executives to the process locally.
Well, we've only got about a minute left, but what's next with this? When will we know if this group is successful or succeeding in what it wants to do?
Well, these are races that will appear on the May primary ballot. So only the Democratic Party, folks who vote in the Democratic primary, will see Democratic Party precinct executives. It actually shows up on the ballot as the Central Committee. There are, of course, races in the Republican Party as well. So after that election, we'll see if there's, you know, a majority of races. Some of these are contested, some affiliated with the Cincy Precinct Project are uncontested, meaning they'll definitely go forward. But the majority that matters is really who shows up to these party meetings and is present in the room on the day to speak up about their concerns and to vote on potential endorsements and party leadership. So we'll know more after the election, but there's still kind of a question mark in terms of how much influence this will have long term.
Okay. In the room where it happens.
Yes.
As the musical Hamilton says. Well, I have been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion and local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you both so much for your time today. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, Lucy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. And our technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. Even YouTube now. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.